and we're going to hear several bills today, so I'll call up first House Bill 2515. I believe that's signing up right now. Would you like a little time to get organized? We can sure. We'll move ahead and come right back to you. I'm going to call on Senate Bill 80. And first of all, we have Vicki McConnell and Eileen Webb. Yes, you certainly can. Opening a public hearing. Oh, yes. Okay. First, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2515 and open the public hearing now on Senate Bill 80. Give your name and for the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell. I'm the state geologist and I'm an ex officio member of the state board of geologist examiners.
Thanks. My name is Eileen Webb. I am a member of state board of geologist examiners.
My name is William Moore. I'm a board member of the state board of geologic examiners.
I'm David Michael, board member, Board of Geologist Examiners.
Proceed.
Thank you. You have a quorum of this board here as well today. We just wanted to show our support and give any opportunity for questions that either you, the chair, or the chair or the board members would have about this bill. Just a really quick synopsis for myself, and I'll let the other board members chime in. But what we're looking at accomplishing with this, first, it's a little bit of a housekeeping bill. We like to go in and look at our statutes once in a while and update when they need to be updated and those things. And in particular, we're looking at being able to go in and have a look at some of the folks that are applying for application for registered geologists or certified engineering geologists to make sure that their degrees have those basic geology classes that are really required to be able to operate as a geologist or a certified engineering geologist. I think you all probably recognize that over the last few years, there's been quite an evolution in criterium and curriculum at universities, and as a matter of fact, even basic classes sometimes are becoming more holistic as you get these cross environmental degrees and degrees in environmental science. And so sometimes that means you have a broader degree, but you may not have as deep a degree in some of the particular professions that you need. So this just gives us an opportunity to review those and make sure those basic classes are being covered before a person can apply for a registered geologist or certified engineering geologist. And I welcome the board members to chime in at any time.
I think you did well.
Could you give your name for the record, please?
My name is Eileen Webb. And I would just support what Vicki just stated. This is really a housekeeping measure and in recognition that I am myself in the environmental field, and so I'm cognizant of a lot of the folks working in my field that call themselves geologists that maybe don't have the basic geology background. It's a broader environmental background they come to. Anyway, I don't really have much to add, but, you know, Vicki maybe said it all.
Okay. Mr. Orr?
Yes. I'm a retired academician from the University of Oregon, and I've seen this this metamorphosis take place from a geology degree over to the environmental and to planning and so forth, where people borrow the terms earth science and geology. And again, the erosion is that what we're calling a geologist, it will morph. It has begun to change. And all we're doing is trying to bring that back to center. My university is in order, but we're trying to bring that back to center so we can, as Vicki said, go in and examine in detail the transcripts.
Okay. Mr. Knight?
I'm David Michael, for the record. I think you have in front of you the letter from Gary Peterson, the chair of the board, that explains this these changes in detail. I think everything has been covered here, with the possible exception of the 45 hours and no degree, where a person who may be short of a degree but has all of the coursework could still get a chance to take the test and become registered. That's probably the only thing that hasn't been mentioned. I think that the essence of the board's need has been covered well. Vicki started it and hit it right on the head. We want to be able to look at the people's degree and make sure that they have the essence of geology as it was originally intended and as we think it's important.
Ask a question. Mr. Orr, I think probably you're in the best position to answer it. How do these requirements and criteria match up with requirements from other states?
In a general sense, they mesh very well. The problem becomes with the other states' geology departments. The problem becomes if you've got environmental departments, or in some cases planning departments, even geography departments, they'll begin to borrow the terms. And then you, when the word earth sciences or geological sciences or geology sort of slips into a title as part of the title, or maybe the whole title, then you see the change. And we've been quite alarmed, and since I've been on the board for several years, to see what comes in, in very rare cases, admittedly, what comes in as a geology degree doesn't bear much resemblance. And I was educated in the 1950s, and so I'm a classical, I admit. But I see the need, because I see people who come before us to get registered. So I think within the Department of Geology, it's fairly uniform. It's just the peripheral parts where we get in trouble.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Several things. I think, Mr. Chair, thank you. First of all, and I don't want to badger the panel, but I would submit there's nothing wrong with having been educated in the 1950s.
Second to that motion.
As a matter of fact, I'm not sure that wasn't a pretty good decade to be educated in, but we'll kind of let that go. I do recognize, of course, that times change, situations change, and even in some of the sciences, there's significant change over a 50-plus year period. And my first question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is, are there any national standards as far as, and I realize we're talking about state certification here, but I'm talking about geologists. Are there national standards for any kind of tests or exams or those sort of things that go with national recognition?
Chair, representative, now may I make a clarification here? Do you mean national standards for being registered as a geologist, or a national standard for just for the education?
Well, I'd talk about. Tell me about both.
Okay. And for the record, I would like to state that I began my education in the 50s. for being a, and actually what we're talking about right here is the criteria that an applicant would bring before the board for being able to apply to take the exams to become a registered geologist or a registered certified engineering geologist. So in order to take the exam, and that, so that's the that's based on national tests, and those are national standards. We go by a certain test and standards that you can take everywhere. So that's that part. For geology degrees, it really depends on the institution, and I don't want to get too deeply in this and get in trouble with our academician here, but it really does depend on the state and the institution. However, there are some very basic structural classes that you would expect to have to be considered a geologist or to have completed a geology degree. Would you agree with that, sir?
Absolutely.
I think the first answer was the one that I was concerned or interested with. The second portion of the question, I understand there is considerable latitude among universities as far as what they put into degree and degree requirement. There are some departments you're going to be, some universities you're going to be required to take some courses, other universities other
Absolutely.
Courses, and I realize we can have, but there also will be, within the accrediting of the universities, there will be certain things that must be met before the university is going to be acceptable to the accrediting association, so that we have. And I do appreciate that there's been some significant evolution. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Hello.
Listen to me. Significant evolution of curriculum in universities. But one of the things, Mr. Chair, that concerns me a little bit is when we're introducing the topic of an environmentalist, and I understand one of our panel is kind of puts herself in that category, so I'm not sure exactly whether I'm out on a limb with a saw in my hand and going to be plummeting to the ground here in a minute. But I would be concerned, I think, within the accreditation licensing of at what and how much emphasis or importance is being placed on these quote-unquote environmental issues. And could you help me a little and enlighten me a little about that?
Yeah, sure. Eileen Webb. First, I I'd like to say I'm not an environmentalist. I'm an environmental geologist. There's a big difference, so you're okay. Don't get yourself out too soon. I think part of answering that question in recognition that a lot of universities have different curricula for required for the degree, we've had a lot of communication with at least Oregon universities, letting them know what kind of applications that we're seeing and where their students that they're releasing with this so-called geology degree are falling short of our requirements. The environmental science degree may include some background in geology, but what we're trying to do is make sure that our candidates have some of those basic core classes. For example, it'd be almost like getting a degree in hydrogeology without having a degree or having a class in groundwater. So what we're seeing is merged departments with earth sciences degrees would be the title of the degree, with heavy classwork in environmental studies without a lot of emphasis on geology. We're just trying to make sure that those candidates that come to us saying they have a geology degree really do have the basic building blocks. So I don't know if that answered your question or not. But
well, I think so. I believe that, is a And I do appreciate the changing times that environmental issues are significantly more important than they might have been in the 1950s, if we can be so bold as to go back to when some of us started our education. Some of us started in the early 50s and didn't complete until the 60s, but then I've been accused of being a slow learner before, and that's all right. I think that's all my questions, Mr.
Thank you.
Chairman. I appreciate the response and the indulgence.
Questions from the committee? Let me just ask one other question. With the changes in the criteria, will all of the present licensees be able to be passed on that same basis? no problems with folks that are already licensed.
No, I mean, are you saying can we go back ex post facto and disenfranchise? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, if they wouldn't pass the new regulations.
Oh no, actually, we've got a population of 1,400 geologists. And I have been in the business since the 1950s. They're a terrific bunch. I can't imagine one of those people that wouldn't qualify. It's just beyond my comprehension. They're really good people. You can be proud of the geologists in the state. You really can.
Okay.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
On your? I'm making an assumption that there's some kind of continuing educational process that the profession of geologists will be expected to keep up with.
It isn't codified. They're kept informed. Any professional geologist is going to keep up, but they're not going to be in business very long. They keep up in journals and so forth. We don't have a codified set of courses that we offer to keep people up. We keep them informed with a newsletter and so forth. But as far as continuing education, I don't see that as a problem. But there's nothing down on black and white.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have some written testimony here from Mr. Peterson.
He's our board chair. He couldn't make it today, but
submitting it anyway.
Right.
Thank you. All right. I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 80, and I believe I will open a work session on Senate Bill 80.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a question. Are we going to be receiving SMSs on the bills in this committee?
You should have one on.
Not on this one.
It's a Senate.
SMS. Sorry, I don't have one. Here's that stuff I gave you before we came down here. That's those packets. They have them.
I got two of them then. You have one, Senator?
I don't. Nope.
Oh, is it all stapled together? Maybe?
It's all stapled together.
Yeah, and that's 80, right? Second one.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. At this point, we're using the SMS that came over from the Senate because that describes the bill as it came out of the Senate.
But, I have no problem when you staple them.
Okay.
I don't know. I always get two of these things.
Yeah,
so
okay.
I put one aside, and that's the one that you have.
So you would prefer that we give them to you as separate sheets down in the future. We can do that.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 80 4 with a few past recommendations.
Second.
Representative Garrard moves Senate Bill 80 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I hear any discussion?
Sounds good to me.
Any opposition? Call the roll, please.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Aye.
Representative Lynn?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Excused.
Senator Anderson?
Aye. The Senate Bill 80 passes. I will close the...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move that we move Senate Bill 80 to the consent calendar.
Excellent. Do I hear any objection?
No objection.
No move. The Senate Bill 80 will be go to the floor on a consent calendar. All right, now we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 43. All right, could I call Alan Kiefert and Jim Craven and Catherine Venata to the podium and Robert Danko. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson. Members of the committee, my name is Alan Kivett. I'm the administrator for the Land Quality Division for the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm here today to ask your support for Senate Bill 43A. This bill comes to you from the Senate with unanimous approval in both the committee and on the Senate floor. And what I'd like to do is give you a little background on legislation and then obviously open up for any questions you might have on it. In 1989, the legislature passed the Toxic Use Reduction and Hazardous Waste Reduction Act. This law requires businesses to prepare a plan to reduce the use of toxic substances in the generation of hazardous waste, and requires DEQ to provide technical assistance to help businesses reduce. Since the law passed, about 1,900 businesses have completed a plan. We usually get about 50 of those plans in per year. The law is as much voluntary as it is regulatory and really focuses on technical assistance. I think that's what's made it so successful over the years. We work one-on-one with businesses trying to help them find ways to reduce their use of hazardous waste or toxic substances. For example, in the last 18 months, we did about 100 on-site visits to businesses that called us asking for us to come out and help them look at their practices. And this is a law that's made continues to make significant contribution to Oregon's environmental quality. We've got numerous technical assistance stories that demonstrate the success, and we pass some of those examples out to you. The plan requirements gets businesses thinking about reducing toxics use and hazardous waste, but the real successes come from companies that then implement that thinking and that planning. And implementation, I think, of this law is a model for how government and businesses can work together to achieve success. So we've taken a look at this legislation that's been in place for 16 years now, and over the last couple of years, spent some time doing a survey of the regulated community, and also then pulling those folks together to talk about what kinds of improvements could we make in this legislation to make it a more successful approach to reducing the use of toxic substances and generation of hazardous waste. And they're basically three things that we came up with out of the survey. There's strong support for toxic use and hazardous waste reduction planning. There's a desire to change the annual reporting required by the law, and there's strong support for DEQ technical assistance. All of last year, we worked with a group of key stakeholders, and there's a membership list of those folks attached to the fact sheet that we provided to you, to evaluate the survey results and develop recommendations to improve this law. And so basically, we came up with the help of this group on some key things we wanted to change in the law. And primarily, it's to change the reporting of quantities of hazardous waste generated into an implementation summary, so that we actually get information that can be useful in terms of what companies have done to alter their practices and reduce the amount of hazardous waste generated. They can also, another idea that was developed by the group and is incorporated in the bill, is substituting the environmental management system for the reduction plan. And also, another important change was making the state toxic substance list line up with the federal list, so we don't have some disconnects there on what people think they're supposed to be reporting on or not. So I think we believe that the various interests that have been involved in this process support Senate Bill 43A. DEQ staff believe the changes will allow for a better and more focused technical assistance, and I think we all believe it will help improve how we can reduce use of toxic substances and hazardous waste in businesses in Oregon. Before I open it up to questions, I'd like Bob Danko, also from the department, to talk a little bit about the amendments that were made to this bill.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Since I'm not expert on hazardous waste, what's the definition of the generation of a hazardous waste? What that means?
There are a list of, excuse me, Chair Anderson, Representative Lim, there are a list of hazardous substances that are regulated both at the federal and the state level in terms of their potential harm to the environment. And so businesses that either use hazardous substances or generate hazardous waste are required to deal with those chemicals and various substances in a certain way. And so what the intent of, and what the, I think, success of this program has been over the years is working with businesses that in their normal practice use solvents or other kinds of chemicals to make products or in their business. Our role at DEQ has been to work with them to identify ways that they can reduce the use of toxic substances or limit the amount of hazardous waste that's generated in those businesses.
Okay, follow-up questions.
Follow-up.
And that during the 2003 legislative interim, DEQ convened a stakeholders group. Who are the stakeholders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, on the back of the fact sheet there, we have a list there of the stakeholders. They represent a wide range of industry representatives, environmental groups. We have representatives here from some of the industry associations that can speak to their position on this legislation. But we tried to have, and I think succeeded in having, a very comprehensive balanced group of perspectives on this work group.
Okay, to your knowledge, any one group opposed this SB 43-A? No one opposing this bill at all?
Chair Anderson, Representative Lim, no, not that we know of.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Mr. Danko?
Mr. Chair, I really don't have anything to add at this time for the department.
All right. Ms. Banana.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. As the department has noted today, they did convene a large stakeholder group to examine the legislation and conducted a broad survey about the program. The product of that work was Senate Bill 43. I participated on that stakeholder group representing the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. My written testimony summarizes our interest in the bill and our support, but there's a couple things I'd like to highlight, and that is that this program and our reform of the program in this bill would maintain the technical assistance from the department to businesses, especially small businesses, as an aspect of the program that has been successful in promoting informed business decision regarding the substances of concern and informed compliance with the program requirements. The legislature has always been very much in favor of technical assistance. We were aware of that in the stakeholder group, and we continue that aspect in this legislation. I would ask for your support.
Okay. Any questions? Let me just ask you, this is a requirement for business to complete. What would you estimate might be the cost for business to submit this plan?
Chair Anderson, since 1989, the pulp and paper industry has been subject to this program. We're defined as large quantity generators, and we have to do certain requirements and submitting plans and things like that. One thing that was of concern with us is that the lists that the department mentioned from what the government defined as substances we needed to report on, what the state did, were different, and they changed that. We believe that, and the removal of a reporting requirement that has now become, I'm very happy to say, obsolete, because we've ingrained this way of doing business into our business practices, and that this bill will actually reduce our costs. We also, at facilities of our size, we also have environmental management programs like ISO 14000, ISO 14001 programs that this bill also recognizes the efforts of those programs in good environmental stewardship at our facilities. But as far as the cost, can't say exactly, but this reduces our regulatory burden.
thank you. One other question, or more a comment, that seems to me that this plan really is more about technical assistance than enforcement and really going after people. And as I mentioned, I think the other day in speaking with some of you, that OSHA has had two arms, one that's kind of enforcement and one that's really technical assistance. I don't know of anybody that doesn't like the technical assistance side. I don't think I know anybody on the other side that really likes the program. I'm glad to see you working in that direction, to be really working together to work something out. Mr. Craven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. And I don't think Mr. Danko stole my line, as he did in the Senate hearing, which was that of all the people in this building, I think Bob and I are the only two who still have the same job and worked on this bill in 1989. And I don't think either of us had gray hair at the time. So it's been a long time since we worked this this bill out. It was the first of its kind in the nation. I remember we had a Massachusetts was trying to chase us and keep up, and we actually had a bi-coastal bill signing ceremony of two governors of Massachusetts and Oregon who signed these bills simultaneously. I think ours was much better than Massachusetts, by the way. I just want to commend the department. We got into this issue last session, and just, you know, when you've got the crush of business and bills already on your plate, DEQ made a commitment to us that, you know, when we finally would during the 2003 session, we would, you know, get people together in when we had the time to really do a good job on this, and that they would convene this group. We would take a, you know, top to bottom look at this law, and the if we could come to consensus, we'd bring it back this session as a bill, and that's what we've done. If you look at that, this is one heck of a incredible stakeholders group on the back of your hand out there, representing lots of different sectors, as well as advocacy groups and business groups in the department. So I just want to commend them for having the willingness to look at this. You know, the point is we maintain the heart and soul of the program and be willing to change some of the processes. And I know regulatory streamlining is sort of a big thing this session, and this is the real deal. This is being willing to you know, continue to protect the environment and do the right thing, but be willing to take a fresh look at what you've required to do. I think 15 years is probably long enough for any law to get a fresh look, and that's what we're doing here today. So we strongly support your urge your passage. Bill passed 27-0 over in the Senate side without opposition, and there is a timing issue here that the companies who've been doing these reports for 15 years or you know, multiple years do need to do a new type of report, as sort of an exit strategy, a declaration of success, as it were, a report saying, what have we learned about this? And those will be public, be shared with other people. So companies that have done exciting things and have learned from doing this program will share that with each other. And those are due about a year from now, so the sooner we can get this bill passed and to the governor and signed, then we can start letting people know they do have a little new requirement to do, but to pay off in exchange is getting out of some other stuff. So I just urge you to move it along. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to call Mr. Johnson. Ed Johnson? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. Questions. Yes.
If I mind, a couple of quick questions. First off, what is the civil penalty today? Yeah, I mean, it says the bill removes a public hearing and allows a civil penalty up to $500. Is there a civil penalty today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, as part of the you know, the delicate negotiations that go on in any bill structure, in 1989 when this law was written, essentially the penalty for failing to do a plan as required was that DEQ could hold a public hearing and sort of hold you up for public condemnation or whatever, you know, in the history of the pit. So there was not a civil penalty under the existing law. There was the penalty, as it were, of having a public hearing and being
follow-up. Sure. You used the word could. That's a permissive sort of word. I assume DEQ has latitude here, then, under current law, they can hold a public hearing, but they may not if they, obviously, they, according to what I'm reading here, they haven't held public readings, public hearings.
Chair Anderson, Representative Jensen, that's correct. We have not held any public hearings.
But is it, is the legislative, and I'm looking quickly in the bill, I don't know where it's at, is the current law, is could the operative word, or does like, current law say will?
Chair Anderson, Representative Jensen, I believe it's a may or could, not a shall, but I want to check on that for you.
If we move this bill forward, it's a moot point. At this point, the concern I have.
I think I have your answer.
Okay.
I had to go through the fine print here. Yep. On page 8, the back side of the AMCROS bill, on line 4, you'll see if the toxic user fails to develop an adequate plan or progress report within the time frame specified, the department shall conduct a public hearing on the plan or progress report. So there is a shall in the current statute that we are amending out. They shall, but I don't think they ever have.
I got a pat on the back to the agency that I want to make if I may, Mr. Chair. And I also have a criticism. And it all has to do with the same thing here. I applaud the agency taking the technical assistance as a way of, overcoming the issue or the problem. I am concerned that when we have in statute that the agency shall, when the agency doesn't do it. I think it would, in this particular light, have been much better in 1991 or 1993 or whenever it would have been to have come back to the legislature and asked to amend that out so that it, than it was to ignore the letter of the law as I'm hearing you state it. And if and when we move this forward, this is all a moot point, so it's, has to do only with other things.
If I could, Chair Anderson, Representative Jensen, I guess I would like to qualify that a bit, and I understand your criticism. I don't know that it's a case necessarily of ignoring the shall as much as it is that people who submitted mostly submitted adequate plans. So I would like to defend the department a bit in terms of it wasn't that we were ignoring this requirement as much as we were, working with people to get adequate plans in the door.
And I certainly applaud the agency, Mr. Chair, for doing that. I think this is the type of thing that not just DEQ, but all state agencies should be doing is making the legislation that we pass user-friendly and making it able to expedite things through so that we have a minimum amount both of, violation of the law and also of interfering with the process of people doing business in the state. So it's a kind of a mixed and a sort of thing I'm stating there, and please understand that I'm glad we're trying to address that problem now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Chair. Jim Craven. The business community who worked with the legislature and advocacy groups back in 1989 to craft this law were very dedicated to making it happen. And I can recall working with my members and with AOI, we did not want people not to comply with this law. And to the point, as I can recall, back in 1990, we were calling down our members prior to the first implementation date and saying, we want as close to 100% from day one as possible. We don't want this to be people ignored the law. So part of the reason why there weren't a lot of public hearings was that there was near universal compliance from the get-go.
And if I could just follow up again, Mr. Chair, and it would be my hope that the technical assistance will be sufficient that we will never have to lead to $500 penalties or anything less than $500.
Great.
Thank you.
I really resonate with the remarks you're making, Representative Jensen. I think the more we can be servants to the people of Oregon and not policemen, except in the extreme cases, the more we're serving our own purposes best. Any other questions? All right. Mr. Johnson.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnson. I'm from Toledo, Oregon. I live right next to a mill. I do know the hazards of a mill, and don't get me wrong, we need jobs in our community. Public hearings PEQ does have, which I hear they don't, we've had them in our community because they wanted to do other chemicals and stuff out of our mill, and they do have these hearings, and that horrifies me to remove public hearings. Because living in Toledo, since I moved there, mill town, I never had breathing problems until after I moved there. Now, I'm not too sure if that's totally because of my spinal condition or if it's because of what gets dumped. The mill between 2 and 4 o'clock in the morning always blows out their stacks of all sulfur and other chemicals that gets dumped on the residents during the middle of the night. I know. I have filed over 100 complaints on it. And it just falls into deaf ears. TV has a line that runs out to Nye Beach. Dumps chemicals out there. There's a half-mile dead zone from that pipeline there. Everything around that pipeline is completely dead. If a fish swims in it, it dies. So that's what horrifies me. We do this with chemicals. We do this. So, I mean, to me, it's sort of like I don't have the bill in front of me. I can't compete on it, but this is what I've heard horrifies me dealing with it. I've asked DEQ over the last many years trying to get a monitor down there so we know it was dumped on the citizens. We've had doctors in our communities to do cancer tests and stuff when they were doing cancer research in the community as their own practice to know what was going on for the male, what it did. They were threatened with their practice and even their lives by people. So when we're eliminating, getting rid of public hearings, we're just allowing the organizations, the corporations, and these companies to cover up any possible death and damages. They're not only doing the environment, but they're doing our own selves and our community. This horrifies me. I live there. I deal with it. I do make the complaints at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. When you can't breathe in the sulfur is, you can't see 5 feet down the street because the stack being blown out. It happens pretty much on a regular basis. So I can sort of say I'm speaking for my town. A lot of anybody who lives around the mill, I live it. It's horrifying. We have to do it. But then again, the sacrifice is, as everybody says in my town, it's the smell of money. You got to get used to the smell of, to do, which is sort of the give and take. But to remove this for any citizen to have any protection for their next generation of kids or a present generation or a present living situation, public hearings, and any penalties for such a small amount for what their profit gains are, we are destroying not only ourselves now, but we are destroying the next generation of what their chances might be. And I'm not saying for lawsuits or anything, but they're just their own health, because We've had tar, we've had other stuff that the companies have written down in the News Times. Lincoln County has another agency, or the newspapers on the state have written about these things and taxed them on chemicals they want to introduce and that they want to burn or flush out of our systems so that way they can just get rid of it. And it happens on a regular basis. So we're poisoning our rivers and streams now. There are other ways we can do this. But take away the public hearings and allow such small penalties. We are just aiding the corporations to sit there and destroy your families and my families and the next generation for profits. And it horrifies me that we're doing this to ourselves in this manner. So I would definitely like to see the public hearings remain at all costs, because without those, the public has no remedy. And by taking that away, we destroy our own children and grandchildren. Thank you.
Question? Representative Garrard.
Mr. Johnson, you mentioned somebody threatened you. Who threatened you?
Oh, I've been threatened by a lot of people within my community for speaking out against the mill. And that's been even by people of that or even law enforcement in my own town. Because, everybody gets their hand greased one way or the other. So, and like me, I make sure I'm prepared in case that happens. I've been through it already myself. So when it comes down to that, we all have to live and protect ourselves.
follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Have you ever filed a formal complaint?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's been formal complaints not only by me, but other residents. It's been written up. I have talked to people in this building about getting monitors down so we can actually see what's being dumped on us. We want to take water samples around the mill so we know how bad it is, because when you go fishing, you get sores on the animals. Fish have sores. Other animals that live around that will develop sores, whatever they're pouring out. Chemical-wise, and it's always getting covered up. It's a standard basis. We've known it. It's been going on since the 70s. You know, but it's like, what are we going to do next? Are we sitting there, setting our kids up right now? In our county, we have a pretty high cancer rate when it comes down to it, especially in my town, out of all of them. And that was written in the News Times, I believe it was 2 years ago, and they did a whole research with cancer, dealing with the whole area, the dump and everything with the mill. But I wish I would have known that. I would have brought the articles up here, so that way it could have been, you know, shown. But I mean, I walked in on blind on his hearing, but when I read it, I was not going to let it slide.
Thank you.
Questions? I didn't catch which town you live in.
I live in Toledo.
Toledo, and
we have a mill. I have the mill just less than about half a mile, to three quarters of a mile, directly from my house. I live in the valley, so when they open their stacks, it literally fills the valley. You can come into town, it'll be clear from both ends of town. The minute you hit in town, it's 10 feet visibility at 2 to 4 o'clock in the morning when they open the stacks.
And the stream that you're on that leads out to the beach?
Oh, the stream, that's the pipeline. That goes from GP through Newport. That goes out to Nye Beach. And that was installed, I believe, in 67. They follow under the grandfather laws, which I'm not disputing that, because I agree with grandfather laws. We have to protect ourselves and corporations as well as ourselves. I'm not disagreeing with that. Don't misunderstand that point. Well, when we've got other chemicals that they have asked to have dumped out there, and we're putting more into destroying our fish and wildlife and other, foods by our food chain, that's what bothers me, because we are destroying our food chain, and we cannot blame it off on other things, and we're part of the problem.
Thank you very much. No questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 43. All right. We will open the hearing now on House Bill 2515. We have Malia Kapilis, and we'll call you up individually.
My name is Malia Kapilis. I am president of Pacific Hydrogeology. And first I'm going to give you a quick background on this House bill. This House bill in 2001 had the name House Bill 2107. Regrettably, it died in committee. And we have reintroduced it, and it has become House Bill 2515. The reason why we've reintroduced this House bill is because it's come to our attention that we really need to do some housekeeping with our legislation. We had a law firm look at the existing contractors' bills and the right of people to put liens on land for failure to pay. And their comments back to us is that the current law, the way it's written, has a problem to it. And that problem is it specifically lists architects, landscape architects, land surveyors, and registered engineers. Unfortunately, of all those professions, geologist is not listed. And their interpretation of the law was, as geologists, we could try to place liens on people's land for failure to pay. The problem is if somebody wishes to challenge that and it goes to court, we're at the mercy of the judge to say, well, just because your profession's not specifically listed here, you have that right. And we would be at risk of the judge ruling that we did not have the right to even place the lien on him. So we're here to do some legislative housekeeping by adding the word geologist or specialty geologist to this. It clears up the fact that, yes, we do indeed have a right in our profession to place liens on land when we do work for people that help them improve their land and develop it and build on it. And so that's why we're here. I would urge you to approve this and pass it on and try to expedite it as quickly as possible. It's something that we really do need just to simply clarify things. And one other thing I might like to ask is, it's my understanding that when a new bill is passed, it always comes with the requirement that it becomes effective. And this is, because this is more of a wording housekeeping issue, I don't know if it would be possible to strike that, because by adding that, it basically sets the law that says, well, gee, if you were a geologist and you've been filing liens, because it's my understanding that there are geologists out there who are doing this now, then some of their clients could come back and say, well, you've been doing it illegally. So if there's a way that we could strike that with Section 2, and we thought for clarity on Section 5, line 21, after the words prepares plans, if you could add the wording reports, that might also help further clarify things. Representative Sumner was very gracious to help me get this House bill before you. We didn't have time to do any word changes from what it was before. But we think with those few minor changes of adding the word reports, and if you feel comfortable omitting the deadline of making it effective and just doing this as a housekeeping word clarification thing, we would appreciate that.
Any questions? Representative Rosemont.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Capillus, I wasn't clear on what you were saying about Section 2. Are you asking for this bill then to be retroactive?
Well, there are people right now in my profession who are currently under this law placing liens, in which case they're saying that it applies to them now. Okay, we, up until 2001, had in our contracts with clients the wording that said that if they failed to pay us, we would place a lien on them. When this House bill came out, we were afraid we were in violation of law, and we removed that from our contracts. So what I'm trying to say is the way the law is written now, in theory, we have the right. The problem is, somebody at some point in time specifically listed some specific professions. Because our specific profession is not listed, if somebody wished to challenge it in court, they could say, well, because you're not specifically listed, you're not allowed. And that's why I'm saying, you know, there are people now, as geologists, who are doing this, and they consider this law to apply to them without that specific wording listing us. So does that make sense? It's like we're not saying that it's retroactive. We're just saying that it already exists and applies to us. Nobody's challenged it yet in court to say that we can't. We're just saying let's add a word of a profession that's been omitted by, you know, lack of thinking of geologists at the time, so that there's a clarification there that this law has always intended to apply to also our profession.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think the problem, though, that I would see is that if you remove that section that specifies when the bill takes effect, there is an automatic effective date on every bill, and unless the bill has an emergency clause, it wouldn't take effect until that kicks in, so I'm not sure you would really be accomplishing what you're trying to do. But
well, that's okay. I mean, that was just something I wanted to bring to you and say, if it's possible, let's do it. If not, we'll live with the consequences. But the most wording I need is if we add that word reports. That's the most critical one.
Any questions? Thank you. Yes. Staff,
would adding the word reports impact any of the other occupations that are listed there?
It shouldn't. I mean, our profession as geologists, we tend to prepare more, I think, reports than architects do. The other people that are listed here primarily are drafting maps and that type of thing. As geologists, we not only are drafting maps and preparing things like that, but we're also a lot of times writing technical reports that go along with those. And so it's kind of a way of expanding out the wording to cover more what we may do in our profession than what is done in the other professions. Because I could see a client coming back and saying, well, you wrote a report, but you never ever made a map for us, so, you know, you can't use this law. That's all. We're just
All right, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, question, Representative Chesley.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Oh. I'm sorry, I didn't.
I thought you were through.
Oh. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, it wasn't mine.
Go ahead, you're fine.
I'm curious, in the historical past, have geologists performed these functions and been unable to attach liens to property, unable to get their compensation?
We have clients right now that we would love to be placing liens against them because they're taking the attitude if we don't win for them, they won't pay us. But we feel that because of the way the law is written now, we cannot place liens. So we have not. I have just recently learned that there are some geologists who are using this law with the wording as it is, but they happen to be engineering geologists. And what has happened is, a lot of times, engineers and geologists work together under one roof in one company. Well, because they have an engineer on board, they can fit into this. But there are companies out there, such as mine, who's very small, and it just happens to be we're two geologists working together. We don't have an engineer on board. And so we're excluded from being able to apply these. And like I said, we had that in our contracts and removed it because we didn't want to be in violation of state statute.
But have the courts ruled against you?
No.
Today?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'm not in opposition, but I'm interested in past history because it seems to me that there may be some language in the statute itself, 87010, any person performing labor upon shall have a lien upon the improvement of, etc., type of thing in, you know, or sub one of that. So it's written at the top here. It's just a kind of clarification that I was looking for, and whether there's been a problem. The issue of specialty geologist, if I can, is this like hydrogeologist? Would that be?
At this point, it would probably apply to engineering geologists. We're going to be in the process of developing, I think, a specialty for the field of hydrogeology, which is the one that I practice in.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. We call Ed Johnson.
My name's Ed Johnson from Toledo. I'm not of any party. I'm just a concerned citizen and resident of the state of Oregon over this alleged statute. What concerns me right off the bat is I can see how the cities are going to be implying this to anybody go in and get permits. If you don't have a geology study, my God, you can't get the permit. That's going to be, I promise you, will be a reality. And then all of a sudden, the cost just goes up to building your home. What horrifies me is putting this into another classification because if people want this type of deal to be added on the property, that is what they do. And as a lady, the sponsor of the bill, was saying, they've already had problems in some of their clients associated already applying this law as it exists. Well, that's illegal right there. They're already doing illegal activities. That horrifies me. Or anybody in this room should horrify them if they already admitted to illegal activities. If this is to go through, dealing with at the request of the owner or agent, I think that should be applied in any city, county, building, so that way to conjunction with this house when it becomes off the statute of ORS 870.010, that the public has a truth knowledge of what the implication of this, and so they're not forced by a city or county and told that if you don't apply this, you don't get your building permit. If you don't apply this, you cannot put your new business up. you don't apply this, you can't put your horse corral in. You know, that's the reality that's going to happen down there. That's my point. That's what I see will happen, and I'll be writing a piece up on that one because I could just see the forecast coming down on the writing on that, that the expenses and costs and the inflation is going to create to build a home.
Thank you very much. Question? Would you like to sign up or respond on that issue?
Mr. Chair, I got here late, and I didn't get time to sign up.
Yes, and I want to call first David Michael.
Chair Anderson, David. For the record, my name is David Michael. I'm with the Board of Geologists Examiners. I'm simply here to offer that the Board of Geologists Examiners reviewed this bill or the concept of this bill previously and was in support of it. We did not put this bill forward ourselves because it's really not the sort of thing that regulation would involve, but we do support the bill. We understand it, and we do support the bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. McKee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Markey. I'm here today representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. Would also like to speak on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, whose membership includes the Oregon Bankers Association, the Credit Union League, the Financial Services Association, and the Mortgage Brokers Association. I'm here today to testify in opposition to this bill. With all due respect to Ms. Capillus, to characterize this bill as a minor adjustment or a minor interpretation of a statute or a clarification of a statute, I believe to be wrong. I'm not an attorney, but our legal counsel tells us that geologists simply do not have the right to lien presently under the law. If there's a geologist connected with an engineering firm and there's a lien filed under by the engineer, I guess that's another issue, and Ms. Capillus alluded to that. But I think the statute is clear on its face. I think an architect, a landscape architect, a land surveyor, or a registered engineer has the right to file a lien, but I don't believe that a geologist does for their services. There are a whole variety of other people that don't have that right either. In reality, this bill represents an expansion of lien rights, and lenders are concerned about every session we have more and more expansion of lien rights. And the question really is, what is a lien right? In order, if we place people under the statute giving them an automatic lien for their services, we are saying you no longer have to use our court system. You bypass the court system. Everybody, including geologists who provide services in this state, have a contractual right to be paid for their services. And believe me, I believe that people ought to be paid. I've lobbied for creditors in this building for 30 years, and I think everybody ought to be paid for their services. But there's such a thing as good business practices. I practice good business practices. I have contracts with my clients. I expect that other people have contracts with their clients. If they don't get paid, they have a right to enforce the contract. If they don't get paid, they can file an action in circuit court. If the amount is under $5,000, they can file an action in small claims court. You're talking less than $100 to file an action in small claims court, and you can have a judgment in less than 30 days if you're right. But both sides get to be heard in a court of law. And if the amount in the contract or the amount allegedly owed is disputed in the contract, both sides get to tell their story and the judge makes a decision. once you have a judgment in the court of law, you get a lien. A judgment in this state is an automatic lien against all real property in the county in which the judgment was taken. So what we're really saying here is, I mean, everybody can get a lien. There's no problem getting a lien. You just have to go to court first. And you have to go in front of a judge, and both sides get to tell their side of the story. What we're really talking about here is, I want to bypass that. I just want the lien. Well, I'm here to tell you that if there's a dispute, the other side might want to be heard. And so what it does is to create a huge amount of leverage for the person who performed the services. And therein lies the problem. Now, when a lien gets filed against real property and there's a lender involved, the lender becomes the unpaid collection agent for the person providing the services. And that creates a huge problem for lenders in trying to clear these titles and transactions, and the liens don't get removed, and it costs lenders a tremendous amount of money. So every session we get, more and more people want liens. They want to bypass this system. I understand that, but it affects other people, and our clients are adversely affected. That's why we oppose the bill. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Yes. Representative Vincent,
can I see you? Could you tell me exactly how your client is adversely affected?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in a variety of ways, mortgages and deeds of trust have a provision that require owners to keep the land free of liens. Keep the property free of liens. If we don't enforce that provision at any time, then later we can be deemed to have waived that right. So if a registered geologist files a lien on a piece of property that we have a mortgage on, and we don't immediately take action against the owner and say you have to clear this or we're going to foreclose on you, if we don't take that action, and then later the borrower comes in default on the contract, we could be deemed to have waived our rights to enforce. And so therein lies a dilemma for us. So then we have to act on these liens to become the enforcing agent. But beyond that, if the liens don't get cleared, and oftentimes they don't, then we have to chase down the people that filed the lien, find out if they got paid, do all that sort of thing at sale of the property. And that can be very time-consuming and sometimes can create a situation where the deal just doesn't get made.
Okay. If the court process establishes that there is a lien and that the lien is appropriate, is the lender then in the same position still?
Yes. Mr. Chair, yes, they are.
Okay. Any questions? All right, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Could be an LLC. Okay. Do you want to quit now on this?
I'm not going to work it today, so we'll get some information on it. All right, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2515. And if there's no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.